the 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 322, Only Your Hearts Know. Sunstone during the Rector Stevenson Peck Years, Part 1, The Daniel Rector Years, a paper by Gary Bajera.
More people to come. That I had a visit just a couple months ago from...
I guess it's 10 o'clock. They tell us to start right on the dot, and I set my clock by the KSL Nauvoo Bell. So I think we're about ready here. My name is Bob Vernon. I'm an attorney here in Salt Lake City, and I'd like to welcome you to session number 322 of the 21st 1999 annual Sunstone Symposium, entitled Only Your Hearts Know, Sunstone During the Rector Stevenson Peck Years, Part 1, The Daniel Rector Years. Admission is by name tag only or ticket. And if you don't have either one of those, please go around the corner to the registration table in the lobby and take care of that.
And how extraordinary that would have been if my mother had been the bishop and if we had had gay women.
We have competition.
It's hard to conceive of.
He would have been a son of a bishop.
Yes.
I don't know.
But I've always thought, too, that if you want to know what
somebody,
the LDS Church will be doing...
experiment with that and then report it to the registration table if we can't take care of that because...
And then the response after...
We have enough conflict as it is with those on the outside. It's hard to handle the conflict.
Professor
of
philosophy at the University of
As you know, this is the 25th anniversary.
Topic. And he comes...
And that's...
originally from
the final
Iowa, but, is not
program of the 25th anniversary of Sunstone itself and the 20th anniversary of the Sunstone Symposium. As such, we have been favored over the past few days with several sessions dealing with the history of Sunstone itself, and one on the history of the symposiums. And this is another session in furtherance of this history. I personally attended one yesterday with Scott Kenny and his group on the early years, and this one is going to deal with the Dan Rector years. There have also been several sessions dealing with feedback from the participants and attendees at Sunstone on what course Sunstone should take in the future. Our speaker today is Gary James Bajera. He was born and raised in Provo, Utah, graduated in 1980 with a B.S. in psychology, and in 1982 with a master's degree in public administration. He was on a mission to southern France from 74 to 76, taught at the MTC, taught French as a French instructor from 76 to 82, and I guess it would take half the time for me to go through and tell you where he's worked and what he's published in. It would probably be shorter if I told you where he hasn't worked in the Mormon community and what he hasn't, where he hasn't published. He has been, as you know, very active in various publications and contributing a great deal to the independent Mormon intellectual community. With BYU Studies, Seventh East Press, Sunstone Review, Dialogue, Sunstone, Journal of Mormon History, B.H. Roberts Society, the Utah Heritage Foundation, the Capitol Hill Community Master Plan, and then most recently, from 92 to 98, he was managing editor of Dialogue, and he was involved with Utah County's Centennial History Project with the Utah State Historical Society, and most recently, up until the present, he is now associate publisher, editor-in-chief, and vice president of Signature Books. The two publications that I guess were his major works that I enjoyed the most was, of course, his History of BYU, Brigham Young University, A House of Faith, published in 1985, and he was editor of the autobiography of B.H. Roberts in 1990, also published by Signature Books. So without any further ado, we'll turn the history of the Rector years over to Gary. And as far as I know, there's no respondent And so as soon as you're finished, if there's any time left over, we'll open it up for questions and comments.
Thanks. You might wish that you could still get the other session. Let me begin first with a clarification. The title of this paper is Only Our Hearts Know, which comes from an editorial that Elbert wrote, an excerpt from one of his editorials. The sentence reads in full, "The examined life is a life of failed but fruitful attempts to capture in words and images that elusive but real something only our hearts know." This paper, too, is the first half of a larger paper. This portion deals just with the years that Daniel was president of the Sunstone Foundation. The portions dealing with Linda Jean Stevenson's 1 year as president of the foundation and then Elbert's tenure as president of the foundation is the last part. But I'll only be reading the part dealing with Daniel. When Daniel H. Rector joined the Sunstone Foundation in early 1986, little did he realize that less than 2 months later he'd succeed Peggy Fletcher as president of the premier forum for independent Mormon intellectual expression. "I came on as business manager," he remembers. "That was my only expectation." After more than a decade at the magazine, Peggy looked exhausted, friends commented. The never-ending stress of balancing people, finances, and deadlines was apparently beginning to take a toll. They also worried that so identified had she become with the foundation and vice versa, neither would survive the other. Perhaps more importantly in her own mind, however, Peggy at age 34 had fallen in love with staffer Mike Stack, who told friends he didn't want to be known forever after as Mr. Sunstone. By late spring 1985, after much soul-searching, Peggy concluded it would be in her, Michael's, and the Foundation's best interests to leave. She and Michael had decided to marry that October, then hopefully relocate to Africa to work for a humanitarian relief agency. Peggy dutifully told members of Sunstone's Board of Trustees of her intention to resign by May 1986, broke the news to her surprised office staff one by one, then informed the Foundation's major supporters of her decision. Initially, Peggy had hoped to convince Elbert Eugene Peck to return to the Foundation, where for 8 months in the early 1980s, he'd helped edit the Sunstone Review. However, Elbert was adamantly opposed to shouldering the burdensome responsibility. The experience had been hard on him in a variety of ways, and shortly before the demise of the Review in 1984, he'd returned home to Vienna, Virginia, to regroup and pursue a career in urban planning. He'd graduated from BYU in 1982 with a degree in public administration. "I took a little sabbatical from life," he recalls. Given his background at Sunstone and earlier at the independent BYU student-run Seventh East Press, which he'd helped to found and edit, Elbert appreciated more than most the challenges facing the new poster child for Mormon intellectual studies. "Peggy didn't see a successor coming, and the Board of Trustees wasn't really doing anything about it," he explains. "So finally," she said to them, "I'm leaving on this date. You've got to deal with it." Its hand now forced, the board appointed a search committee, wrote a job description, and again approached Elbert, who again said no. With only a few weeks left to train a replacement, Peggy and the board jumped at the obvious solution and invited Daniel to serve as the foundation's new full-time director-publisher. "I felt inadequate," Daniel remembers, "both from the perspective of being responsible for the financial side and especially for the editorial side. But I was flattered and confident I'd be able to find someone to take over the editorial side, so I didn't really hesitate." Ambitious, eager to please, and sometimes stubborn, Daniel at age 29 brought to Sunstone more real-world business experience than any previous publisher. That wouldn't be difficult, the Foundation's past directors might joke. He'd graduated from BYU in financial and estate planning, started a master's program, sold tires, worked for financier and Sunstone booster Stephen Christensen, until the latter's murder in October 1985, then briefly for the short-lived Mormon Heritage magazine in Utah Valley. However, Daniel didn't have a background in editing, design, printing, or magazine production, nor much personal interaction with the independent Mormon intellectual community. To fill that void, he and board members aggressively lobbied a still-reluctant Elbert, promising that he wouldn't be responsible for fundraising or the foundation's precarious finances. "I came to Peggy's farewell party in early May 1986, Elbert recalls, knowing that I'd probably sign up with Sunstone. Daniel was taking over and recruited me to come on as editor. That seemed much easier than being editor and publisher, which was an overwhelming burnout kind of job." 3 years Daniel's senior, a reinvigorated Elbert agreed and commuted between Utah and Virginia for the next several months, before relocating permanently to Salt Lake by mid-August. Thanks to previous editors, the new team started with a backlog of issues ready for press. At the time of Daniel's and Elbert's appointments, the Board of Trustees was a relatively recent creation, and according to Daniel, reported to the president publisher. Consequently, the precise relationship between the new president and editor wasn't clearly specified when the two took office. Some insiders assumed, according to Kent Frogley, a trustee from 1985 to 1997, that Elbert essentially reported to Daniel. However, Elbert was given to believe that his and Daniel's positions were co-equal. As Elbert later wrote to the board, "We operated under two different organizational assumptions. Elbert assumed he was an organizational equal to Daniel, hired and responsible to the board. Daniel thought that he had full oversight of the organization, that Elbert reported to him. This lack of clarification wouldn't be formally resolved until 1990. As the fifth child out of nine of an LDS journal authority, his father Hartman was a member of the First Quorum of the 70, Daniel sensed the fine line he walked between his own commitment to independent thought and his family's deference to the institutional church. I remember talking to my mom and dad about it, he says today, and Dad encouraged me to do it. He gave me his blessing, so to speak. He supported me in that decision. I remember him saying that it would be good to have someone with a testimony at Sunstone. He knew that I wanted to do it, and he's always been supportive of that sort of thing. However, Daniel continues, I never really asked my siblings what they thought about it at the time. I found out later in conversations that some of them did have some concerns about it, but I think they too were more or less supportive. Daniel also knew that some of Sunstone's readers feared, given his background, he'd bring a reactionary conservative orientation to the pages of the sometimes freewheeling magazine. One advantage of growing up in a general authority's home, he wrote in late 1986 in his first editorial for the magazine, was that I never shared the popular conception of church leaders as nearly infallible authority figures. I therefore tend to be quite independent in my views. Of his own plans and beliefs, he offered, I am a believer, most of whose beliefs are constantly changing. Our content will remain essentially the same, he promised longtime supporters, then added for his more mainstream constituency, with perhaps a better balance of articles reflecting the values and attitudes of our predominantly believing readership. Utah-born but East Coast-educated, Elbert combined an infectious romanticism with a sense of street-smart politics. In one of his editorials, he half-jokingly termed this mixture his chameleon manipulative tendencies. I am acquainted with the disillusionment that comes from discovering that things are not as I was taught and believed, he confided in his first issue, with the despair from realizing that nothing in heaven functions as it ought, and with the cynicism from concluding that things may never change. But, though now believing fewer things than I did before, he continued, in what I believe, I am more certain. For Elbert, Sunstone was a tent into which all people gather who thirst to explore the Mormon Church's doctrine, culture, past, present, and future. Thus, Elbert knew that satisfying the sometimes competing expectations of the magazine's readers, including church leaders, he'd later discover, would pose one of his biggest ongoing challenges. Sunstone would lose its vitality if it became merely a publication in which only liberals addressed other liberals, he explained, repeating perspective each already believed. Rather, the fun and work of Sunstone lies in its role as a forum for differing ideas and issues on things mortal and heavenly. He promised that the magazine would continue to boldly discuss cutting-edge issues of Mormonism, though it would remain a vehicle for discussion, not an activist journal advocating specific reforms. Like Daniel, he predicted an era of continuing improvement, not dramatic change, making Sunstone better at what it does best, sharing ideas and discussing issues. Together for the next 5 years, Daniel and Elbert retained most of the magazine's traditional features instituted during previous editorial administrations, resurrected some previously abandoned ones, and introduced the Mormon Psalm, or written prayer, and a creative writing contest. With an eye to saving money and facilitating production, they simplified the interior layout and design specifications, standardized the length of articles and placement of illustrations and poetry, and raised the subscription price. Gradually, the number of issues stabilized at about 6 annually, while the number of pages per issue leveled off at about 64. In addition, they greatly expanded the number and locales of various foundation-sponsored symposiums and lecture series. Before the close of their first year and after a marathon repainting of their offices, they also moved in late November from the old Bennett Paint and Glass building on First South in downtown Salt Lake City, which is about a half a block east of here, to the basement of the Carpenter building, some 7 blocks south and west. Daniel knew that his primary strengths were common business sense and fundraising, that his first priority was getting control of the foundation's roller coaster finances. His predecessor, especially toward the end of her tenure, hadn't always rigorously monitored salary structures, met state and federal payroll withholding requirements, or tracked accounts payable. In fact, according to its minutes, Sunstone's corporate charter was temporarily suspended in June 1986 for having failed to file an annual report and renew its license. Consequently, Daniel found the financially strapped organization he inherited in worse shape than even he expected, eventually owing the IRS nearly $20,000 in back taxes and fines, with other debts totaling approximately $24,000. At first, Daniel thought the foundation owed the IRS only $7,000. Other payables wouldn't be discovered until months later as well. One vendor garnished the foundation's bank account during the 1986 August symposium, a surprise development that caught Daniel and Elbert completely off guard. It was a blow, Daniel remembers. I wasn't even aware of it. And Daniel was required to guarantee personally all payments owed the IRS. 2 months later, an out-of-state printing subcontractor refused to publish the cover of the current issue, not because of money problems, but because, according to Sunstone's minutes, of its Mormon orientation. Peggy must have mentioned Sunstone's financial situation to me before she left, Daniel stresses, and I may have forgotten about it. I don't remember specifically, but it didn't come to a head until I was on my own. Even so, I don't remember it being particularly weighty on me, but it was a major effort to get that paid off. His wife's reaction was different. The whole affair was hard on my wife, financially, socially, and religiously, but I was oblivious to it, and she probably felt that there wasn't a whole lot she could do to dissuade me. Still, he certainly didn't have any illusions about it being an easy job to keep Sunstone afloat. I knew that bills had gone unpaid, that dealing with creditors was an issue, and that payroll was a problem. But while Peggy had been fully disclosing of the situation, some of the details did come as a surprise at the time. Faced with such problems, Daniel quickly moved to identify and prioritize all outstanding debts, arranged for a repayment schedule with the IRS, and negotiated other payables down by 50 cents or more on the dollar. He also considered, but ultimately rejected, having the foundation take out a bank loan that would be guaranteed by at least three Sunstone supporters. In March 1987, he cut payroll by almost $25,000, reducing three employees from full-time to part-time status while letting two others go altogether. Gradually, due in large measure to a combination of creative fundraising, including brokering in-kind tithing donations to the church, directed mass mailings and subscription incentives, and periodic arm-twisting, the foundation's total long-term indebtedness began to shrink, though it would take until 1991 before it disappeared completely. Unfortunately, this would not remain the case. The reductions affecting Sunstone's employees proved especially painful. Particularly upsetting for some was the fact that no one received advance notice before Daniel announced, imperiously, some felt, the changes in a staff meeting as a fait accompli. I handled that situation very poorly, he now admits. I was insensitive. I lacked experience. I really didn't know how to handle it. I feel very badly about that still. If some employees at the reductions didn't affect Daniel and Elbert, they were mistaken. Before the cuts, Daniel was earning $26,000 and Elbert $20,000. By comparison, Peggy earned about $5,000 in 1985, her last full year. After the cuts, both salaries were reduced by 25%. 14 months later, following a financial upswing, both were restored to their previous levels. And the next year, each was increased by $2,500. During Daniel's first three full years, from 1987 to 1989, the foundation's net income increased 85%. Income from sales of the magazine quadrupled. Total expenses rose 75%. Payroll as a percentage of expenditures dropped from 64%, 75% in 1986, to 50%, while the foundation's net operating surplus deficit, which was minus 7% in 1986, ran plus 6%, plus 6%, and 11%, respectively. Much of the improvement in Sunstone's finances can be directly attributed to the increase in subscriptions, one of Daniel's most impressive achievements. I believe that the bulk of the increase in subscriptions, he explains, can be accounted for simply in how we went about marketing the magazine. We got mailing lists we hadn't had access to in the past. This People's List, for example, was very good for us. My goal was to try to reach the natural audience that I believed was out there, but had been largely untapped. I'm sure there were some things that people were interested in, which we used as a hook. But I also think if we'd used another come-on, we still would have been successful. The other issue that was important to me was to try to broaden the readership of Sunstone. I felt that Sunstone is a leavening influence in the church, that it does good things, but that its effect is proportional to its readership. At one point, during his second year, Daniel even tried approaching Gordon B. Hinckley, then a counselor in the First Presidency, in an attempt to bolster readership. Daniel had arranged for a meeting with President Hinckley, explains Albert, partly because we were both naive enough to think that he may be on the that he may, on the outside chance, accept an invitation to speak at the symposium, and if not, perhaps grant an interview with the magazine. So we went to his office. He was very warm and friendly, but said he had plenty of forums, that he didn't need to speak at the symposium or give an interview. When we left, Daniel and I hugged him. I remember saying to Daniel, "Well, he may not agree with us, but at least he knows we're two well-intentioned people with good hearts." I'm not sure President Hinckley came away from our meeting with the same conclusion. In fact, Daniel and Albert were disappointed to learn later that President Hinckley had reacted less than positively about the encounter. "I find talking to general authorities about Sunstone to be difficult," Albert subsequently explained to members of a Mormon-oriented electronic discussion group, "because they're not in a mode to discuss a topic, but to counsel you. Throughout the whole interview, they're asking themselves, what should I tell this person? I think it's difficult for them to have an open conversation with people they don't know." Where direct solicitation by letter, telemarketing, and personal endorsement didn't always sell new subscriptions, controversy and timing did. Without question, the two most successful issues produced during Daniel's tenure in terms of sales were August 1989, which featured the first publication of George Peeley's letters to the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve, following his excommunication for apostasy, and the cluster coverage in September 1991 of Elder Paul Dunn's fabrication of some of his best-known baseball and war stories. Daniel used both issues as incentives to attract new subscribers, assuming they'd stay on board once they began receiving copies. As a result, total income from magazine sales rose 127% from 1988 to 1989. While the number of new subscriptions outpaced renewals by 2-1 in 1990, total sales likewise increased in 1991, with new subscriptions again accounting for more income than renewals. "It made a big difference in our cash flow," Daniel acknowledges. During these 3 years, 1989 to 91, the magazine generated nearly 40% of the foundation's total revenues, an accomplishment not repeated since. By the time of Daniel's departure in late 1991, the total number of subscriptions had jumped from 3,500 to 10,000, an all-time high. The downside to this aggressive approach was threefold. First, the increased print runs boosted total expenditures more than 75% from 1989 to 92, while net income climbed only 44%. Consequently, Sunstone's annual operating surplus deficit began to reverse from a high of plus 11% in 1989 to negative 6% in 1990, negative 8% in 1991, and again negative 8% in 1992. Second, many new readers subscribed only for the Lee letters and Dunn expose and didn't renew their subscriptions expired. Some even complained that they'd been tricked into buying a liberal publication. Third, according to Daniel, "I don't know, but what the increase in subscriptions also had the negative impact of drawing more attention to us from the brethren, or perhaps making us seem a more credible threat in certain respects because we were growing." Albert concurs, "I long believed that if the brethren can't participate in the kind of conversation Sunstone champions, they'd at least appreciate overhearing it and know what people are talking about. I don't think they saw it that way, however. I think they saw us as lobbying them and eventually took umbrage." Still, despite a downturn in renewals, the net effect of Daniel's strategy seems to have paid off, with the number of copies printed for each new issue in 1999 hovering at around 4,500, an increase of 29% from 1986. After 2 years as editor, Albert had mastered most of the technical aspects of producing the magazine and running the office, and was beginning to focus on editorial content. With as many opinions regarding the magazine's philosophy as readers, he hoped to involve the Foundation's Board of Trustees in a wide-ranging discussion in late 1988 of Sunstone's future. Historically, the board had provided little input regarding submissions, leaving almost all such decisions up to the editor. Peggy had been a benevolent autocrat, Daniel quips. In fact, Sunstone never really had a fully functioning board of trustees until mid-1986, when its bylaws were reworked to better reflect the legal requirements of nonprofit foundations. Albert explained to board members that currently the magazine was divided into the following categories: features, columns, reviews, and news stories. We try to have a balance of history, contemporary issues, liberal and conservative perspectives, he reported in the board's minutes. With pride, Albert could point to past articles that represented the magazine at its best. Carl Sandburg on Pascal's Wager on the Mormon Roulette Wheel, Ed Kimball's The Administration of Spencer W. Kimball, Tony Hutchinson on Prophetic Foreknowledge, Arthur Bassett, How Much Tolerance Can We Tolerate, Ed Firmage's Hugh B. Brown in His Final Years, Malcolm Thorpe on James E. Talmage and the Tradition of the Victorian Lives of Jesus, Gene England on Why Some Utah Mormons Should Become Democrats, and Levi Peterson's A Christian by Yearning. Barring some egregious transgression or ultra-controversial topic, the board reaffirmed its continuing hands-off policy with regard to the magazine's contents, preferring instead to oversee finances, help develop issues and encourage writers, brainstorm sessions for the annual symposium, and conduct year-end merit reviews for the foundation's paid officers. The board always trusted Elbert to make prudent decisions, notes former trustee Kent Frogley. Elbert exercised a pretty strong hand in making all editorial determinations. He did it understanding the wishes of the board and taking their advice, but he's ultimately the one who made those decisions. I can't remember any time when the board said to Elbert, you can't publish this article or you can't talk about this topic. In at least one instance, however, Daniel remembers a trustee intervening to prevent Paul Toscano from writing a continuing opinion-oriented column for the magazine. Subsequent notable articles include Hugh Nibley on What is Zion?, Scott Kinney's God's Alternate Voices, Gene England on Prejudice Against Blacks and Women in Popular Mormon Theology, and Todd Compton's Non-Hierarchical Revelation. My position, Elbert later explained, is that the magazine and the symposium should host a healthy variety of perspectives. We try very hard to achieve that, although to be candid, there are many more so-called liberals than so-called conservatives who participate. Many conservatives are uncomfortable with being on the same platform as liberals, some whose views they see as heretical. I find many liberals who see themselves as open and tolerant to be just as intolerant of conservative views as liberals. It's a sorry polarization among Mormon intellectuals, but I guess it's understandable because religion is so much closer to our heart than even politics. Because of the imbalance, ironically, conservatives actually have an easier time getting into Sunstone than do liberals, who have to be more competitive for the available slots. Frankly, I'm tired of the liberals who continually assert their right to discuss things independently. I say, let's quit being so defensive and hierarchy preoccupied and simply discuss important topics. One of the things I think I brought to Sunstone, he adds today, was a strong connection to BYU faculty and was able to get a lot of them to speak at the symposium and write for the magazine. Within some church circles, the magazine was occasionally seen as challenging to the faith. So I wanted not to eliminate those testimony-challenging articles, but to supplement them with affirming pieces, which Peggy had tried very hard to do. In retrospect, those first few years were simple compared to what they are now in 1999. The same can't be said for running the office during those years. At the time, he continues, it seemed to me that I was working every waking minute. After Daniel reduced the number of staff, I managed our database, including subscription lists, while trying to do everything else with the magazine. There wasn't a lot of time to focus on all the things we wanted to do. Elbert's quest for balance wasn't always easily pursued in the LDS community, especially in the Sturm und Drang of the late 1980s and beyond, when probing treatments of problematic issues in Mormon history or personal confessions of disbelief were increasingly demonized as anti-Mormon. On the one hand, as Elbert points out, Sunstone was sometimes seen by conservative Mormons as liberal, even heretical. On the other hand, offering a variety of views, including conservative responses, would help ensure Sunstone's independence. It wasn't unusual for especially controversial articles to generate both new subscriptions and angry cancellations. Elbert always viewed this development as a sign that he was succeeding in his quest for balance. One of the most direct responses to Elbert's quest for balance came in early 1990. Since 1989, Elbert had been running an irregular column entitled A Changed Man, by former Sunstone contributor Orson Scott Card. Elbert felt that Card, a nationally award-winning science fiction writer, brought a thought-provoking conservative voice to the pages of the magazine. Card's fourth column, which appeared in the February 1990 issue, dealt with what he termed the hypocrites of homosexuality. Signature Books, which distributed the magazine to bookstores and other retailers, informed Sunstone that if it continued to publish, in Signature's view, such offensive opinion, it might need to find another distributor. Some at Sunstone saw this as an attempt to stifle freedom of expression. Signature responded that just as Sunstone was free to publish what it wanted, so Signature was free to distribute what it chose to. The reaction from Sunstone's readers proved equally divisive, with most published letters condemning Card's views. Despite promises to continue his participation in Sunstone, Card never submitted another column, and 8 years later castigated the magazine for reprinting without his permission an excerpt from one of his earlier Sunstone articles. As for the magazine, Elbert insisted that Sunstone would not be determined by its distributor, while Signature, which continues to distribute the magazine, hasn't backed down from its position either. Ironically, in the same issue as Card's article was Wayne Scow's open-minded essay on Homosexuality, Mormon Doctrine, and Christianity, A Father's Perspective. But where Card's piece had appeared without an editor's notice, Scow's column featured a disclaimer by Elbert. While most of our readers do not agree with his revised theology, all can empathize with his struggle. We present this essay only to enhance understanding of a growing challenge for the church. When some readers complained about the discrepancy in approach, Elbert apologized for insulting our readers' judgment and intelligence and for prejudicing Scow's excellent essay. He was only trying to assure an unencumbered presentational tone, he explained, for an article whose speculation that Christ approves of gay marriages might engender reader outrage that the magazine was forcing its agenda on them. Obviously, Scow's handling of the controversial topic was of greater concern to Elbert than to his perceptions of his readers' sensibilities than was Card's. Unquestionably, the single most controversial issue published during Daniel's and Elbert's 5 years was their treatment of Paul Dunn's war and baseball stories. When news of Utah journalist Lynn Packer's investigations into the veracity of Elder Dunn's background began leaking in 1989, Sunstone decided not to weather the possible political fallout from the sensational story, but to wait for it to appear elsewhere, then run it as a news story. When word of Elder Dunn's fabrications finally broke 2 years later, Sunstone devoted that September to an entire issue to the topic. Although this episode is a painful one, Daniel and Elbert explained in their preface, we believe that a sympathetic yet thorough inquiry into the matter is salutary, helping us to become a stronger and more honest community. Then followed a string of national news stories about the incident, Packer's comprehensive Paul H. Dunn Field of Dreams as the lead, Elder Dunn's comments to the Arizona Republic as a rejoinder, and finally a series of thoughtful personal reactions. The decision to devote almost an entire issue to the subject wasn't an easy one. Some of the Foundation's trustees had serious misgivings about the gotcha tone of the undertaking. More than a few longtime subscribers announced that they were either canceling or were not renewing their subscriptions, and at least one prominent historian promised he'd never again submit an article for publication. By January 1990, the lack of clarification between Daniel's and Elbert's positions, as well as the disparity in compensation, had become unbearable for Elbert. With Daniel's support, he drafted the following statement for the Board of Trustees. Given the diverse nature of Sunstone's activities and the need to establish financial, editorial, and symposium contacts, Sunstone must commit to supporting competitively salaried positions for its full-time directors. The organization's troubled business and editorial history emphatically makes this point. Of course, the amount of the salary must partially be determined by the financial health of the organization and by comparative salaries in similar organizations. Of what he viewed as the ambiguous relationship between them, Elbert wrote tactfully, obviously we have worked well together, but now feel a need to clarify organizational lines. He proposed that the board create two separate yet equal positions, Daniel as president, responsible for the business aspects of the foundation's projects, and Elbert as executive director, responsible for the program content aspects of the projects. Regarding the magazine, these two positions would be publisher and editor. He also recommended that the annual salaries for the two positions be equalized at $35,000 each. This proposal gives each position the autonomy it needs, he wrote, editorial not being compromised by business motivations and vice versa, and encourages the essential collaboration necessary to execute the foundation's projects. The board adopted both recommendations with the increase in salary to begin the next month, though it stressed that it was not committing itself to a policy of always paying its officers the same amount. While both Daniel and Elbert were satisfied with the outcome, Daniel regretted that Elbert hadn't first approached him privately. I wish Elbert had been more direct with me, he says today. I don't think it was necessary to have involved the board. I would have been open to clarifying our relationship and coming to the same conclusion without having the board render a decision. Elbert's action was a surprise. I was unaware of the depth of his feelings about it. If I was hurt at all at the time, it's only because I wish Elbert would have dealt with me directly. The most far-reaching challenge to Sunstone's editorial independence erupted later that year, following its publication of a news story about the church's recent changes to the temple endowment ceremonies. Earlier that year, news of the changes had appeared in print nationally. Church members quoted in favor of the modifications soon found themselves answering to their bishops and stake presidents for having commented publicly about the ceremonies. In some instances, their temple recommends were confiscated because they'd ostensibly violated the temple oath of secrecy, a charge each denied strenuously. In July 1990, Daniel and Elbert asked their board for advice. Since they were planning on running a news story about the episode and feared outside influence to quash the article, the board told them it would support whatever decision they made. Shortly after the story appeared, 2 months later, Daniel and Elbert were summoned to meet with their stake presidents, who chastised each of them for running the article and seized their temple recommends. The foundation's trustees were outraged that a simple news story should have elicited such a coordinated response from the church, remembers Kent Frogley. News of the discipline quietly spread, but Daniel and Elbert declined to comment publicly, both worried about the possible impact of the news on their families and feared that Sunstone's reputation might be damaged in a public confrontation. "I didn't expect the action taken against me," Daniel now explains. "Although it wasn't too devastating to me, I think it was a real turning point for my wife. I'm also sure it was painful to my parents, although I don't remember them making an issue of it. I thought it was somewhat obligatory on the part of my stake president. I don't think it was something he wanted to do. He was doing it because he'd been asked to. Ironically, he was released the next Sunday." Elbert's reaction was more personal. "I was shocked when my stake president called me in. It was particularly hard on my relationship with my stake president, who I later found out from my area president had lied to me when he said he was acting on his own. The whole experience was very distasteful." Shortly afterward, Elbert happened to run into a Sunstone supporter on the BYU faculty and John Carmack of the church's First Council of the 70 on the University of Utah campus. According to Elbert's diary account of the encounter, Elder Carmack said that while there is good and bad in the magazine, it is becoming increasingly bad. To illustrate, he cited the recent editorial in the most recent issue. After some confusion, it turned out he was talking about the unsigned news story on the temple changes. He said the story was hostile towards the brethren and mean-spirited. He said that since it was obvious that the authors knew that the brethren disapproved of talking about the temple, even to the extent reported in the article, that to do so did not sustain them nor recognize their keys. He said that was just not his opinion, but all the brethren's. As a result, he said, there must be consequences, clearly alluding to the removal of Daniel's and my recommend. Writing to another longtime Sunstone supporter, Elder Carmack was equally blunt. "The church has a right and a duty to grant or withhold special privileges of a sacred and confidential nature. With Sunstone of late, the tone is critical and cynical towards sacred things. It is of concern to almost all of the brethren, yet in a spirit of tolerance and forbearance, the brethren do not command, but rather suggest." Of his own experience with his stake president and with Elder Carmack, Daniel recorded, "John Carmack told me that the temple is not the main issue that got our recommends revoked. He thinks the leading brethren are sending us a message to get out of Sunstone. He was confident that some action would have come soon in any case because the church leaders all disapprove of what we're doing. He didn't seem to be clear about how to proceed from here. He said he would find out what options we have in solving the situation. My stake president had never read Sunstone before he was given our current issue. He had never heard of dialogue either, in spite of several years in CES. He was more open than Elder Carmack, admitting the fallibility of church leaders, but said he didn't like this issue of Sunstone and he wouldn't have it in his home. Nevertheless, he said he could be a fighter, but that I'd need to give him some ammunition if he is going to be able to fight for me." Daniel also met privately with Neil A. Maxwell and Richard G. Scott of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles. "I wanted to know," he recalls, "if another shoe was going to drop. It didn't, at least not then, and not for Daniel." During this turbulent period, Elbert wrote an unusually candid editorial for the December 1990 issue of the magazine, entitled "Weeping by the Waters of Zion." In it, he recounted a crisis of faith, not unlike the one he was now facing, after leaving BYU to work on the Sunstone Review. "A dramatic crescendo caused me, reluctantly and sorrowfully, but honestly, to question the teachings, testimonies, and personal experiences of my past," he wrote. "I faced these terrifying possibilities alone, not choosing to burden or frighten friends, and correspondingly, I felt increasingly estranged, not only from my religious tradition, friends, and personal history, but also from God, and from rich attributes which I knew existed in me and which I celebrated, but which did not now animate me. After a tearful encounter with his own existential demons, Elbert concluded that the compelling truth of Mormonism for him lay not in any abstract gospel principle, but in a ward of imperfect Christians whose crazy lives demand our binding moral responses. More and more, he would write 8 years later, I see my spirituality primarily as glimpses of the divine through interpersonal and social relations. Elbert no doubt found solace in similar thoughts as he now contemplated the possibility of future church action against Daniel and him. As it turned out, however, Daniel asked for and received back his recommend early the next year. I didn't have to make any promises or apologize for anything, he says. While his stake president made it clear he didn't like Sunstone, there were no conditions on giving it back. At the same time, Elbert never asked that his recommend be returned and has never applied for one since. I didn't want to engage my stake president in anything else after that, he says, and I didn't want to be beholden to the church. What Elbert wouldn't discover until later was that his stake president had decided to leave the case to his successors to find a final solution. In addition to the personal price they were paying for their association with Sunstone, Daniel and Elbert continued to combat the growing impression that independent Mormon thought in general, and Sunstone in particular, was somehow detrimental to Mormon faith. Although the church had long been suspicious of unsupervised intellectualism, until Elder Dallin Oaks' General Conference Alternate Voices talk in 1989, the official discourse had largely focused on content. With Elder Oaks' watershed sermon, however, the field expanded to include warnings against not just topics, but forums for discussion, such as the annual Sunstone Symposium. Following the August 1991 symposium, the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve issued a proclamation cautioning members about recent symposia, which Sunstone dutifully reported in its September issue. We appreciate the search for knowledge and the discussion of gospel subjects, they wrote. However, we believe that Latter-day Saints who are committed to the mission of their church and the well-being of their fellow members will strive to be sensitive to those matters that are more appropriate for private conferring and correction than for public debate. There are times when public discussion of sacred or personal matters is inappropriate. There are times when it is better to have the church without representation than to have implications of church participation used to promote a program that contains some, though admittedly not all, presentations that result in ridiculing sacred things or injuring the Church of Jesus Christ, detracting from its mission, or jeopardizing the well-being of its members. In the wake of the rare joint statement, Daniel and Elbert tried to remain positive, stressing publicly, "We believe that in the long run, an open and honest examination of the varied perspectives of the Latter-day Saints and their friends helps to build the kingdom of God." But the effect privately was devastating. It was a big deal, Elbert remembers. We were very surprised and reflected on it on almost every decision we made. The Board of Trustees worried that further action might be taken against Daniel and Elbert, feared that subscriptions would plummet, symposium attendance would no longer submit articles and reviews or participate in or even attend the symposium. They brainstormed how best to respond, wondering if they should try to meet again with President Hinckley to explain their position, mobilize a letter-writing campaign to church headquarters, and or write a group letter to all our selected general authorities, perhaps moderating our stance on talking about the temple in the magazine and symposiums. At the same time, several of Sunstone's supporters complained vocally in local newspapers about the church statement, and in some cases were summarily relieved of their ward callings or threatened with official church discipline for speaking against the brethren. Pressed for a response to the apparent crackdown, the church's spokesman elaborated that Mormons guilty of open dissent, meaning conflict, discord, strife, objection, protest, rebellion, contradiction, or to differ, disagree, or oppose, subject themselves to the possibility of church discipline, whether it is formal or informal. Ranking church leaders agreed. If doctrines and behavior are measured by intellect alone, Apostle Boyd K. Packer said at that October's general conference, the essential spiritual ingredient is missing, and we will be misled. There is safety in learning doctrines in gatherings which are sponsored by proper authority. Those who would add upon could well be guided by the anchor question of, do my writings, comments, or observations build faith and strengthen testimonies? Continued Apostle Marvin Ashton. Oftentimes we cause confusion and misdirection in our lives and in the lives of others if we promote the startling and unorthodox. Do not turn to public discussions and forums, Elder Charles Didier added. Clearly, ranking church leaders were convinced that the freedom of thought and unfettered intellectual exchange promoted by Sunstone and its supporters, or at least what they perceived was being promoted, could somehow damage the faith of its members and the authority of its leaders. With equal passion and conviction, Sunstone and its supporters believed that restricting the freedom of Mormons to think and express their opinions violated the very essence of their cherished religious beliefs. Tragically, much of the conflict can be attributed to the fact that busy church leaders often rely on the reports of subordinates or lay members, neither of whom may accurately reflect the content of the magazine or sessions of the symposium, rather than attend sessions or read issues themselves. The potential for miscommunication, even misrepresentation, in such situations is unavoidable. Sadly, the belief in a Mormon intellectual agenda or organized underground bent on modernizing church doctrine and practice is as prevalent in some quarters as it is false. Inevitably, Elbert wrote in his own unpublished history of the magazine, this discussion diverted Sunstone's attention somewhat away from the general exploration of things Mormon to focusing on how, why, and sigh if we should talk about and research Mormonism. Lamentably, the debate has consumed much energy and many magazine pages and symposium hours, enlivening some scholars, demoralizing others. For some months previous to the church's statement on symposia, Daniel, now 35, had been wrestling, much like Scott Kinney and Alan Roberts before him, with the belief that given his growing family, he could no longer afford to stay at Sunstone. Financial and other pressures were beginning to mount, and with the equalization of his and Elbert's status and salaries, future significant pay raises didn't look promising. Nor did it appear that church leaders, his father included, would lessen their appeals for him to leave the foundation. Thus, in September 1991, after more than 5 years as foundation president, and less than a month after the church's statement on symposia, Daniel informed the board of trustees that he'd accepted a job elsewhere and would be reducing the amount of time he could devote to fundraising to one day a week. The board decided to separate fundraising from the rest of the publisher's responsibilities and retain Daniel on a six-month renewable contract as president of a development board at an annual salary of $7,000 plus a 10% commission on donations of over $110,000, a challenging but not unreachable amount. This would give Daniel considerable flexibility but require that he report to a new co-executive director publisher. At the time of my departure, Daniel now confesses, I was unwilling to acknowledge a relationship between the church's statement on symposia and my decision to leave. Money was an issue. My wife felt strongly that I should move on, but I was also getting pressure from my parents. So as I look back on it, I have to admit that the statement was definitely a factor, but I don't think it alone was the trigger. My parents felt that and that there was a chance that I might lose my membership in the church, which seemed laughable to me at the time, and they began to get frantic about it. I know my dad was getting pressure from the brethren to set his own house in order. The situation was very hard on me. First of all, it made me very angry that they would lean on my dad in a way that I thought was completely inappropriate. Then I was sad that my dad felt he had to say or do something about it. I think he was just afraid for me. I know that it strained his relationship with his associates. It was a hard time for everyone. And at the time, I was in denial about my real motives for leaving. I didn't want to leave under pressure, but I did want to move on. I felt, I think, that I was a victim of timing and circumstances. Of the effect on his own religious beliefs of his 5 years as publisher, Daniel notes, those years had a salutary effect on my faith. I was very much engaged in faith, and I know that I felt a responsibility to be a role model and not be a bad example. But aside from that, I've always been invigorated and challenged in a positive way by Sunstone. I didn't come to the foundation with any illusions about the brethren. I came naive and left with my naivete intact. My experience was faith-affirming. However, the later experience on me of the excommunications of September 1993 was detrimental, even devastating in certain respects. I was estranged from the church and still am in many ways as a result of that. I never felt that way while I was at Sunstone. That's the end of that half. So for any time that's left, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or try to answer any questions any of you have about Daniel and his years at Sunstone, or if you have questions about Linda Jean and the year that she spent here, or Daniel, or Elbert after that, I'd be happy to try to respond to that too.
I think we ought to give Gary.
Sure. You'd like me to just comment on Linda Jean a little bit?
Yeah, just tell about her.
Linda Jean, some of you may remember that Linda Jean, when Daniel left, Linda Jean, the Sunstone's Board of Trustees issued a job announcement and solicited applications for Daniel's replacement. They narrowed down the applicants. I'm not sure how many there were. They narrowed them down to three. Linda Jean was one of them, Linda Jean Stevenson. Linda Jean had been working in New York at the time, and she worked for a publishing group that published house magazines, interior design magazines, things like that. And she worked with them not so much on the editorial side as on the special events side. If they had fundraising things, she would help coordinate the planning for the underlying event of that. And so she applied for the position, and Board of Trustees was very interested in her. She presented herself very well. As it turned out, once she arrived in Utah and took the job, the specific responsibilities that she had as the publisher were a little bit different and much harder than she had expected. And she tried to do what was expected of her, but after about a year, it became apparent that it just wasn't working out. It was much harder, and she was having a real hard time with it. And so she and the board both reached this conclusion at the end of that first year that it would be in her best interest and in Sunstone's best interest if she maybe shifted out of Sunstone and was able to find something else to do.
Was that because she hadn't been involved in the Mormon intellectual community?
It was probably a variety of things. One was that she wasn't connected into the Mormon intellectual community or even into the Salt Lake community, really. But also, it was just different. She was expecting something different than what she found when she came out here and really got involved with it. The really unfortunate thing as far as the foundation goes from that period of time is that when Elbert then later took over and was appointed the following year, in January of 93, Sunstone's foundations were in even worse shape than they were when Daniel took over. And it apparently was a seriously bad time for Sunstone's foundations. They were like $50,000 in debt, something like that at that point. And it took them a long time. And I think right now, the latest issue has an editorial by Marianne Morgan, who's on the board right now, and she says that Sunstone is not in debt, but Sunstone is broke. So that kind of gives you, in terms of Sunstone's foundations, is probably a pretty good, it's, relatively speaking, it's a better situation to be in than it has been in the past sometimes.
Is there another session in this?
No, there's not. I originally I wanted to do one on Elbert. And so I made the proposal to talk about Elbert, and I sent the copy to... By the way, I did send a copy of this to Daniel, and he's read it, and his wife Lisa has read it as well and gone over it, and they've made some comments about things. But Elbert didn't want me to talk about him at this time. He has things that are going on right now, and he talked about this. If you want to hear about Elbert, buy tape 236. That was when he was interviewed by Brian Waterman and Brian Cagle. And he talked a little bit about his current situation with his stake president. And that was primarily what I don't think he wanted talked about publicly anyway, was his ongoing discussions with his stake president until that gets resolved one way or the other. But since he talked about it at that session, I don't feel too badly about just mentioning it briefly here. Daniel works, he lives in Salt Lake. He and Lisa and his family are here. He works for a software company called Exegesis. And actually, Scott Kinney works there too, which is kind of interesting. And Daniel, I think, is the sales rep for the software company, and I think they specialize in business applications. And he does, he attends things periodically, and I think he was on, I think he met with Sunstone this week to look at the program and kind of help out there if he could.
Is he on the board, or does he have any connection?
Is Daniel on the board of trustees?
Does he have
no
any connection?
No, he was. After he left, he stayed on. Unlike Linda Jean, Daniel stayed on as a member of the board of trustees. Although he must have rotated off by now.
I guess he's.
I think so. And he also stayed on with fundraising, but organized fundraising as a group never really took off the way that they were hoping. And I think they just eventually kind of just let the development board lapse. Although there's a renewed interest in fundraising now, and Elbert's issued a call to try to establish a $100,000 and then a $500,000 endowment for Sunstone to kind of help it through the lean time so that they can at least continue publishing. John, did you have a... No, when Daniel talked about this, it was a hard thing. And to be honest, I was kind of surprised that Daniel didn't X this out when he had an opportunity to review the paper. But he left it in there, and I asked him about it. It's interesting when you talk to Daniel, because Daniel's memory sometimes gets fuzzy in about certain episodes in the past. And the part in here where I talk about Daniel and Elbert's visit with Gordon B. Hinckley, when I asked Daniel about that, he said... Did we meet with Gordon B? You know, I don't think he's being disingenuous about it, but I do think that there are times when maybe some of those compartments have been pushed way back, and he tends to focus on the present and the future rather than the past. I didn't pursue it with him to ask what kind of pressure, and I don't even know if he would have known what kind of pressures, except, you know, that the can't you get your house in order kinds of things. George? I've become more interested in the role and function of the board after writing this paper than I was as I was working on it. And John Ashton may be in a position to talk about the board while he served on it. I understood, John, that the board really didn't exist while Peggy was publisher, except toward the end, and that the board really came on more as a search committee for her replacement. And then when Daniel came on and they reorganized and really had truly functioning trustees at that point in mid-1986, but I could be wrong about that, I'm not sure. From 1986, then they did have a functioning board to meet the requirements, the legal requirements of a nonprofit foundation. And the board, as Kent Frogley has talked about, his experience with the board is that they really didn't do very much in terms of the magazine, that they did leave it up to Elbert to decide what was going to be published. They weren't a very proactive board in terms of the content of the magazine and the symposium, unless they were asked to be by either Daniel or Elbert. And it's only recently, within the past 3 or so years, that the board has taken on a much more activist role in terms of content. And you can see that with some of the recent publicity that's come out about the symposium. And also, Daniel and Elbert had an interesting... Stan Christensen, the current board, the chairman of the Board of Trustees, had an interesting exchange in one of the issues, I think maybe 2 years ago, where they just kind of talked back and forth about that. And that's kind of interesting to see. Some board members, they seem to serve as long as they want to. And I think they're for like 3 years, but they renew automatically unless they say, I don't want to. And some people do rotate off. Ed Kimball was on for, I think, a 3-year period, and he decided at the end of that it would be probably advantageous to leave and let somebody else come on. But other people have stayed on for a long time. Kent Frogley was on for a long time. Glenn Lambert was on for a long time. Some of the current board have been on for probably 5 to 8 years, too. Not that long, but people like Robin Knibbe Davis... Margaret Reiser, they've been on for a long time.
What about, I don't even know if you're privy to this, I suppose you are. Is there a comparison between dialogue and the pressure for dialogue? Was on for Sunstone? Do you think Sunstone may be on the board against pressure?
I think that Sunstone is much more of a lightning rod, especially the symposium. The symposium seems to be the thing that gets them in trouble the most. Dialogue experiences this kind of stuff as like a neighbor, you know, of Sunstone. And so the Dialogue, I'm sure, is aware of what's going on and some of the pressures and things like that, and with articles that come in. But Sunstone is certainly more, because they're in the public eye more than Dialogue and some of these other organizations, I suspect that they're the ones that really draw the attention. But all the other ones, they hear about it, and within board meetings and stuff like that, they talk about it and reassure themselves that things are going to be okay or that things are real bad or that kind of stuff, and just try to move on and to really do the kind of thing that they think that they should be doing that their readership wants them to do. I think that Sunstone is still about 3,500. I'm not sure. It might even be a little bit less than that by now. And I think that dialogue is probably less than 3,000.
Did you see Sunstone got up to 10,000?
Sunstone was up to 10,000 at one point. Yeah, Daniel was very aggressive, and he was able to do a lot with that.
Mm-hmm.
It probably depends on who you ask. If you ask Stan, I think he would probably be pretty upbeat about things and where they stand. And I think he feels pretty positive about his own experiences with whoever he's been meeting with and the things that they've been telling him. I'm sure there are other people who say, this is not the way to go about this. You give a little bit, and then you give a little bit more, and pretty soon there's nothing left. It's hard to know. I mean, I'm sure that there are some of the general authorities who think that Sunstone is a necessary evil, but there are probably others who would be happy to see it gone. No. No, not there. And if there were, it would be my opinion, and I tend to be kind of cynical in situations like this, so I don't think it would be a real objective or informed opinion. But Stan and Albert both have been very careful to say that they have tried this year to make this one not sensational and to try to involve speakers or topics that they thought were going to be problems for the symposium. They've been very blunt about that. They've said, though, that the only topic in general that they wouldn't do this year, regardless of who was going to do something on it, was on the temple. But there have been speakers, there have been individuals that they've said no to, rightly or wrongly. They've made those kinds of decisions. It's too bad, I think, personally. Decisions like that should be based on the quality of the presentation rather than the topic or the person. Yeah, although he does say the temple. Oh. Rebecca said that, okay, that at the other session, the interview, it's session 236. You should buy it, the tape of it. It's an interesting interview if you're interested in Albert. That he said that anything that was turned down was on the basis of quality and not for any other reasons. My own take on this is that that's probably 99% true. There are people that I'm sure, regardless of what they wanted to talk about, under the current in the current atmosphere, Albert would have said no. Anyway, thanks for coming. I hope you enjoy the rest of the symposium.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate that very important historical information. You filled in a lot of gaps in my knowledge. And all I want is the whole story, and that's why I come to Sunstone and read dialogue. It's really sad that we have to go through some of these things, but I really appreciate, from a personal standpoint, the lightning rods that some of you, and you know who you are, either here or on the tape, that have to take the heat for a lot of us so that we can improve our knowledge. And I really appreciate that. And Gary, you're one of them, and I appreciate that very much. I wanted to tell you that in answer to your situation, real fast here, session 131 was where Stan Christensen sat around in a circle and discussed that article and said part of that article was not true about some sort of a rift between him and Albert. But you'd have to talk to him in more detail to get most of that information. 131, that may not have been recorded. It's on page 12 of the program on Thursday, session 131. It was not recorded. So you just have to talk to Stan personally. And by the way, I on the business page of the April 17th Salt Lake Tribune, there was an indication of an appointment to a new position of Linda Jean Stevenson here in Salt Lake on the Wyndham Hotel. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Thanks to everyone. If you want tapes of the sessions, go around the corner in room room 253A in the book room, and they'll be glad to help you out. Thanks for coming.